And welcome to the program. We're back. We're here. Sunday night. Sunday evening. And look, thanks. Good to be here. Got a lot to go over. And just who's ready for the 4th of July? This is like my favorite holiday. I love it. I love this country. And I know we all love this country. I'm going to just talk about this for a minute. But there's a tremendous appreciation for what this country has when it has sheltered you as an immigrant. And I know I've talked about this, my story a little bit here and there, but I'm going to share it with you here in the spirit of the holiday that's coming up no sooner than tomorrow morning. And kind of remind all of us what this is, you know, what it is that we're celebrating. You know, we talked yesterday about Brexit and about the turmoil that was the 20th century in Europe. And my parents, both of them, were born in Prague in what was then Czechoslovakia. You know, another state that some politicians thought they could put together, but ultimately it came undone at the seams and the country's divorced peacefully. Stop me if it sounds familiar. At any rate, imagine this. So they both are born in the same country in the same city, and you know, and Europe. Look, I mean, World War II was a traumatic thing. Again, we talked about it. Get the podcast from yesterday. We had a great show. Samnation.com. It's all on there. Get it. But here's the thing. Look, so World War II ended, and it talk about out of the frying pan into the fire. 1945. Czechoslovakia is liberated, okay? And 7 years of Nazi occupation, which I don't have to tell you did not go well, was over. And a period of, exuberance, right? I mean, you're liberated, you're done, the Nazis have been defeated, and your country begins rebuilding, but not so fast, because the Soviet Union was on the scene. And in the conferences, including Malta, that followed the end of the war, you know, our president Roosevelt, a celebrated president, who I think is one of the worst in our nation's history, sold out Eastern Europe and gave it to the Soviets, and turned over my parents' country to Moscow. Well, there was, you know, well, it's not the official story. The official story was that there was a spontaneous revolution where the Czech people were just so excited to be controlled by another despotic dictatorship. They were just so excited they could barely contain themselves. But that's not how it went down. And so in 1948, there was a communist coup. And a puppet regime of Moscow was installed in my parents' country. And this is why I love this country and why I'm a conservative. Because what happened, the decline, the enormous just destruction, cultural and economic, that occurred in the Stalin years. It's all attributable not to Stalin as a dictator, but to communist ideology, taking businesses away from the business owner, turning them over to the government, letting the government manage them in a collective. Well, any guesses on what happens there? Any ideas? I mean, the productivity goes down. Nobody cares. I mean, there's no evil guy at the top making profit. You get it? Right? There's not this one person or group of shareholders or family that controls the business. It's not that one farmer with a small plot of land. He cares about that land because his livelihood depends on that land producing a crop. Now, take his land from him, which is exactly what happened. Take the land from his neighbor and from his neighbor on the other side and turn it into one big government farm. And each to his own, you know, all that nonsense, political BS, communist BS, socialism. Take from the 1%. Confiscate their wealth. Take it all from them. And so, imagine this. You know, my mother's family is, you know, 1 a.m. and the trucks roll in. Everybody out of your beds, out of your house. Turn everything over to the government. We're taking over your factory. We're taking over everything. And people were sent. And now, you know what? You think that the concentration camps ended in 1945 when they were liberated by American troops and Soviet troops? Wrong. Those camps, political prisoners, work labor camps, death camps, Soviet Union, they wrote the book on it. And those camps are there. The evidence of those atrocities are there to this day. Now, I'm just telling you, don't think that it was just the Germans at the end of the war. So my parents grew up under Stalin, and it was a terrible thing. And my father lived, his family was moved out from Prague, or moved into a little town. And yes, the government could tell you where to move. They had that much, we can't even imagine that. Moved into a little town, and he dreamed of America. And he told me one time, I saw this picture. I wasn't even supposed to have this magazine. I saw this picture of a cloverleaf interchange. You know what I'm talking about? L.A. He saw a picture of L.A. And for him, it was like something out of a sci-fi movie. For us, it's something like out of a horror movie because we're stuck in that bloody traffic every day. But for my dad, this was the shining city on a hill. 1968, after a period of liberalization, and I don't mean the liberalization, the kind of liberalization that Obama's given us. I'm talking a relaxation of the hardcore socialist policies, hardcore communism. The country was getting towards some normal place and starting to distance itself from Moscow. The Soviet Union said, no, don't want any of that, and reinvaded my parents' country. And my father, my mom was out on a school trip at the time. They didn't know each other very well. They certainly weren't married or dating or anything like that. But my mom was out on a school trip, and my dad was in Prague. He said, I can't live like this. So he packs himself, if you can imagine this, he's a young guy, mid-20s, and he packs a little suitcase, a few little shirts and things, and he doesn't return to his country until I am 10 years old in 1989. All right, think about that. So he goes to Holland. He moves to Holland. And there, he's surprised. He's shocked. He hears, what does he hear on this? He ends up being a journalist. He's a writer for a newspaper. And he reads all the same BS, all the left-wing BS. By the way, the stuff that we're still listening to now from the left. Some of this nonsense that Bernie's been spewing, that so many of our young, basically brain-dead millennial youths have their panties in a twist over. All that stuff, guess what? All of Bernie's BS was implemented. It was implemented in my parents saw it firsthand growing up. Take money from the rich, confiscate, nationalize, da-da-da-da-da. It didn't work. It created misery. And it changed a society of people who were motivated, bright, industrious, and over 40 years made them just dolts. Drones, go to work. You know, the old adage in communism is we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. Right? Think about that. But I said 40 years. So the first 20 started to relax a little bit at the end. And then the Soviet Union reinvaded. My dad said, that's it. I'm out. Went to Holland, is in Holland. And he hears the same stuff from the liberal media. Well, we need to raise taxes, and we can't have too much government. You know, we can't have too much private property rights, and we can't do this, we can't do that. And my parents are looking at each other. They say, we cannot live like this. And they moved to America, 1977, and they come here in the middle of Jimmy Carter, who, by the way, if you didn't live through Jimmy Carter, you're lucky. Okay, if you're my age or younger, you don't remember the Jimmy Carter years. But many of you, Missy, you remember the Carter years. I mean, look, some of you were working during the Carter years, and this is terrible. You know, it's terrible. It was the same silly economic principles at play. You know, just, you know, our taxes were 90%. Neil Cavuto on Fox Business had some idiotic millennial on, some driveling idiot from I don't know what college. And how are you going to pay? He asked her, how are you going to pay for all these pipe dream programs? This is a classic example of a Bernie Sanders voter. How are you going to pay for all this program? He's going to 1%. The 1%, they're going to pay for it. Oh, they're going to pay for everything. 1%. What happens when the 1% run out of money? What happens if they leave the country? And that's what happened. Just ran out of money. Margaret Thatcher says the great socialist experiment ends when you run out of other people's money. And this is it. So my parents come here. Reagan gets elected. I've got pictures of me in a stroller and signs for Reagan. And what my parents witnessed in this country, this nation coming together and rebuilding itself from the scrap heap of Vietnam, from the scrap heap of Carter. I am telling you, there is no country on earth like this one. We are so resilient, but elections matter. And I want you to think tomorrow when you're having your hot dog, when you're having your hamburger, when you're watching fireworks, what kind of country do you want to see? Because a president like Reagan made a difference and brought us back from the brink. And we're at a brink right now. And I think you make the right choice, we can be brought back from that. And we can become a country that we all are proud of. So let's talk about this Benghazi report, and I'm going to read some headlines to you and tell you why. If all you read is a headline, you get everything all wrong. It's classic. They do that on purpose, by the way. You know that? Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation Talk Radio, 790 KBC.
This is Sweet James. I listen to Sam Nation.
Okay. All right. Benghazi. All right, who's... I mean, look. I think this is a deliberate. This is a deliberate play. Because what happened there? What happened? I mean, the what Obama and Hillary did or didn't do when it came to Benghazi is, if it's not a crime, it ought to be. But you've got to understand, we're dealing with very smooth and sophisticated political operators. And the whole purpose here was to drag this probe out so that you and I and the rest of the American people would be so fatigued and bored by this that we would just gloss over whatever came out. And this is exactly, I think, what's happening. And I look at these headlines. I look at, you know, CNN had a headline when the Benghazi report came out on Tuesday or Wednesday, whenever it was this week. Benghazi panel caps two-year probe. No bombshell. False administration. I like the LA Times one even more. Republicans release Benghazi report with no new evidence against Hillary Clinton. Yeah, okay. So if I'm reading that headline, and I'm a low-information voter, and That's it. I read it. I go, hey, there's nothing new there. I'm done. Next. What are the Kardashians doing? Let's get back to TMZ. Oh, this boring political stuff. So here's the deal. To me, Benghazi is simple. When American lives are at risk, you move the full might of the American military to protect them. It doesn't matter if you are a citizen, an ambassador, a member of the military. You know, for those of you who have served our country, you know, if you're in the military, you don't leave a man behind, or even a woman, or even a transgendered person if you don't know what they are. You don't leave them behind. Am I right, Robbie? Yep. That's you. That's right. Combat search and rescue. And you, I don't want to say you drop everything to go help whoever's left, but you do. You do. The mission itself becomes many times subordinate to the rescue mission. But here's the problem. You have, and we're, look, Obama's done his damage. He's, and I know, he's still in office and he can still do more damage and he is trying. Boy, is he trying. But the thought of 4 years or eight of Hillary Clinton, a continuation of the disdain that they have for the military, that weakens this country terribly. We're going to talk about that today. Because here's the deal. There was not a single asset, a single military asset that was deployed to help the embassy that was under siege in Benghazi. Okay? Well, I wasn't an embassy. I was a diplomatic. Whatever. It is what it is. There was American personnel, American lives that were under siege. Distress call went out. And we've gone through the timeline here before, but you go through the timeline and it's terrible. It's terrible. And now I want to ask you, what kinds of things do you think Hillary Clinton was debating? No, but it's a serious question. Because if there's a do we go, do we not go, are we going in, are we going out, what are we doing? Okay, now I understand that when you have to deploy military assets, that's a big decision. It is. But humor me here for a minute. First of all, when you're a leader, you have to make big decisions and you have to make them quickly and you have to be bold and the fundamental thing is you've got to be a decision maker. So what kind of decisions were being made as troops waited in bases in Spain, for example, which are Spain? Well, yes, we're Spain. It's really close. Spain is Southern Europe on the Mediterranean. Libya is North Africa on the Mediterranean. And those jets could have been there. I don't have the exact time, but within the hour. And by the way, when you're getting attacked by a bunch of guys with Kalashnikovs and rocket launchers, and a couple of F-16s show up, just two, game effing over. Okay? How would you have felt if you were in that embassy, in that compound, hiding under a table, getting mortar attacked, bullets whizzing through the air, and every minute that goes by, you're wishing that some air support shows up or ground forces? Well, I'll tell you what was being debated, and I'll tell you why this is important and why this... I'll just tell you where it fits into this whole Hillary Clinton assessment. If you're on the fence, if you're thinking about this, you're going, the Trump guy, and I don't know, and Hillary, she's got problems. Okay, let me break this down for you. You know what they were talking about? You know what the State Department, Hillary Clinton, what she was agonizing over? State Department officials on an emergency conference call during the Benghazi attack brought up concerns about whether Marines that might be deployed should wear uniforms. Now, why is this, you ask? Well, they were concerned about how it would look. Would it be too threatening? Would it be too... I don't know. Unfriendly. Are you kidding me? This is real. Now you're going to say, oh, Sam, that's just silliness. And you know, this is a big Republican witch hunt. I mean, that's just nonsense. How does this fit in with everything? I'll tell you. There's a book out, and you've probably heard about it. It's called Crisis of Character. I have it here, and I'm working my way through it. And it's a book written by Gary Byrne, who was stationed. He was a uniformed Secret Service officer who was stationed outside the Oval Office. He actually, his career began during the presidency of one George H.W. Bush. So he was, I think, a two-year veteran of the Secret Service at the time of the first Bill Clinton campaign for president. And this would have been 1991. I was a mere Ute at the time. I think I was in the sixth grade, something like that. Sixth grade. I remember that. And, okay, so what happens is that ever since Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated, we start having Secret Service protection for our candidates, serious candidates. So that's why, you know, I think, does Bernie Sanders still have a security detail? I think he still does. I mean, he's out of the race, still has a detail. As long as he's officially a candidate, they protect him. And Byrne talks about what happens? He volunteers. They need people to go from the White House to going out into the field and protecting candidate Bill Clinton. And he gets, you know, and he gets put on this detail. And one of the things that he says, and it's very interesting, he talks about this. It's a repeated theme in the early part of the book, because he talks about how the Clintons had nothing but disdain for anyone in a uniform. In fact, staffers would repeatedly tell them, now you're saying staffers, I know, where do you think that the staffers are getting their directions from? The Clintons would repeatedly tell their uniformed Secret Service officers that they wanted to dress them in plain clothes. And it talks about this constant insistence that the Clintons wanted all these officers to look like good guys, whatever that meant. Perception of good guys. It was important to them. They wanted to dress down military personnel. Remember Mogadishu? Oh, wait a minute. Maybe you don't remember that. Mogadishu was the first military intervention that Bill Clinton led, and it was a complete and utter disaster. Have you seen Black Hawk Down? And one of the things that Clintons were debating back in the Mogadishu days was, do we send them in with uniforms? And they decided, no, we don't want to send people in with uniforms. Now, maybe you know somebody in law enforcement, and you need to ask them about uniforms and what they say. There is a reason our police officers wear uniforms. It is a reason why those uniforms need to look scary. Because when a cop shows up and there are 10 hostile parties, does that happen? Of course it does. If you're a cop, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You show up somewhere, backup isn't there, and you've got to keep everybody calm. Well, you know how you keep people calm? You scare the living daylights out of them. And you don't do it when you show up in a frilly clown suit. You've got to be in uniform. That uniform conveys, I'm here, I'm in charge, I'm in control, I have a weapon on my side. Do you know that during this Benghazi attack, as people are cowering with bullets flying overhead, Hillary Clinton is debating whether or not the force that is sent into the country should even be armed with their personal weapons? Think about that. I am telling you that Hillary Clinton is somebody that cares more about the optics of a situation than she does about American lives. And the idea of making her commander-in-chief of this country is sickening. So we're going to come back to this. I want to get through this. I'm going to tell you, I also want to talk about this book. Because I've heard some criticisms of it. And I'll tell you what the best defense is. When you have people say, oh, it's just politically motivated drivel. And why did he come out with it now? I got an answer for you. Back after this. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, Talk Radio 790 KABC.
This is James Bergener. Finally, there's a weekend radio show that doesn't suck. Listen to Sam Nation with me every Saturday and Sunday.
So we're talking about Benghazi, and before you turn the radio off, you're like, I'm done with Benghazi. I don't want to hear any more of it. I'm going to tell you the parts of this that matter, because we're talking about this uniform nonsense, right? If the military has and trains for rescue missions, they have forces on standby across the world that are ready to extract, protect, do whatever it takes, their embassies, their assets overseas, whatever it is. And so whenever there is an embassy or a diplomatic outpost established, there is a contingency plan drafted and rehearsed and planned for months before any personnel even begin to staff that place. So you've got to understand the Benghazi thing isn't Hillary going, oh, how do we do this? How do we do this? There was no plan that needed to be drafted. There were no, you know, who do we send? How do we, that you just press a button. You just press a button and you say go. But the sickening thing is that Hillary was agonizing about all the stupid things that really are purely political. And people died. The uniforms. We're just talking about the uniforms. Do we send them in with uniforms? Do we not? You know, there was there's some testimony that's in the report, sworn testimony under oath, and it was from military personnel. That was on that strike force that eventually, but late, was deployed. We were told, and this is a quote, we were told multiple times to change what we were wearing, to change from camis, meaning camouflage, battle gear, okay, uniforms, into civilian attire into camis into civilian attire. It's a platoon commander. There was also some talk of whether or not we could carry our personal weapons. This is just not acceptable. This is playing politics with human life. Might I add, with the security of the United States. You know our problem with ISIS right now? Is that they don't take us seriously. You know, I saw Obama on the news talking about the attack in Istanbul at Ataturk Airport. And he's talking about Daesh, which, by the way, if you don't know, that is the French term for ISIS. And ISIS is actually a highly derogatory term. And Daesh is this French term, which, of course, to John Kerry and to Obama, it sounds very sophisticated, you know, very, very smooth. Very Ivy League, highbrow. Also, you know, they don't even want to insult ISIS. They don't even want to call ISIS ISIS, let alone call Islamic terror what it is. It's more than that. They don't even want our military assets when they're deployed into a Muslim country to be wearing the American flag on their uniforms. They want them showing up in Van Halen t-shirts. I don't get it. What are we? What is this? Somalia? I mean, I'm curious. You know, when you have a company and you put your people in uniform, it makes your company look better than when they're not. I mean, and I don't mean, you know, but for example, my office, we have a uniform, suit, tie, white shirt. That's the uniform. If you are a janitor and you work as part of a big janitorial company and your company has a brand, you wear your company's brand on your uniform. And I see that, I go, oh yeah, that's that great company. They do great work and they're wearing their uniform. You show up with that uniform. That uniform says something. I'm here. I'm great at what I do. And I'm part of this team. When you've got a bunch of insurgents, read terrorists, read enemy combat, whatever, and they're attacking Americans who are under siege, you don't want to show up wearing t-shirts. You want to show up with the American flag on your arm, on your chest, wearing your uniform, carrying your weapon, because you know what? Your chances of having them turn around and run the other way and not even want to fight are much higher. The reality is, and this is something that I was talking about, this book by Gary Byrne, who's the Secret Service agent who wrote the tell-all book about the Clintons. He talks about this I know everybody wants to get to the meat of the juice of everything going on, but in the first part of the book, he talks about why the Secret Service has uniformed officers. And it's because as in protecting the White House, your success is stopping an attack before it's even formed. You want to be visible. You don't want Secret Service hiding out, invisible, plain clothes. I mean, they have plenty of those guys. But they have uniformed officers because it sends a message. Look at that guy. He's watching you. He's patrolling. He says in the book, he goes, my best day is when you have somebody who's planning to attack the White House. Scope it out. Check everything out. See all of us doing our job and say, report back to headquarters. Hey, you know what? It's too well protected. I don't want to attack. And that's what wearing a uniform does. But the Clintons, and I talked about this, the Clintons, when the Secret Service was assigned to protect candidate Clinton in 1991, the first thing that the Clintons wanted is for the Secret Service agents to not wear any uniforms, to be invisible. They wanted to let people through. Do you know this is crazy? The political expediency, they were constantly getting in the way of the Secret Service, allowing Secret Service personnel. They wanted Secret Service to not allow people, to not make people pass through metal detectors. This is a joke. They were constantly overruling Secret Service protocols because you know what? They knew better. They were smarter. They had it all figured out. And so procedures that were planned, that were meticulously put into place, that resulted from a failed assassination attempt on, say, someone like Truman, and a successful assassination attempt on President Kennedy, that from assessing threats, all these procedures that the Secret Service had accumulated over 50 years, the Clintons come in and go, I don't think so. We're going to do it our way. Officer, we're going to tell you how to do your job. That kind of contempt, politics over patriotism, not just patriotism, but over common sense. Everything comes down to politics. And by the way, this book here, I had somebody tell me the other day, well, you know, Sam, you can't read that book and read it for anything other than being this, it's a political attack piece. Why? The guy experienced this in the 90s. I mean, and he's writing about it now. And so I put my lawyer hat on. And I said, yeah, but this guy, he, this isn't his first time telling the story. It's his first time writing a book. But you know, he's told the story before. What, to who? What do you mean? No, he hasn't. It's the first time we've ever heard of it. That's right. It's the first time you've ever heard of it because all you do is watch CNN. Retard? No, really. He testified all of this to someone named Ken Starr and to a grand jury under oath. And that was back in 1996. So I want you to wrap your head around that. When someone has a consistent story today that they had 20 years ago, when it was current and fresh, to me, that equals credibility. When you have a guy who is a sworn law enforcement officer, whose entire job, okay, job, career, heck, even retirement, rests on him not being disqualified from that. Like, oh, I don't know. Lying under oath? Perjury? So if he testifies truthfully, okay, 20 years ago, and then follows that same story 20 years later, to me, that's substantially credible. But you're not going to hear that, are you? The Clintons are spinning it. And I've heard a lot of things. Oh, you know, why is it released now? Oh, and then you've got people. Well, there's no way he could have heard that. I mean, he was a uniform guy. He wasn't plain clothes. And the plain clothes men are the ones that go in. No, look, I'm telling you. You know the guy that's the Secret Service agent that is disputing Burns' account? Some guy that is pretty reputable. He's a chairman of an association of these Secret Service guys, professionals, security professionals. They've got some club, okay, something. And he's retired, and he's head of this club. If you dig a little deeper, you realize that this is a guy who served in the Clinton White House, and he got in trouble with his mortgage, and Hillary Clinton wrote him a letter that helped him save his house. But you're not going to read that in the New York Times. You're not. So the one guy from the inside that the Clintons have been able to dig up to help them fight this narrative happens to be somebody with whom they have a personal relationship. Of course, that's not being disclosed. So, what are the Democrats worried about in this report? What are they saying? They're saying the Republicans are playing politics. And they're saying that this report costs too much money. I can't make this stuff up. It costs too much money. Let's talk about it here in a minute. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, Talk Radio 790 KABC.
This is Sweet James Bergener. I listen to Sam Nation.
Uber, the rideshare service. Many of us use it. Great, great, great stuff. They've had, what is it? Uber boat, Uber helicopter. What a nonsense. I don't know. Uber horse carriage. I don't know if they have that. But now they're adding a service, Uber balloon. That's right. In China, Uber's trying to gain traction, become the number one rideshare company. And so they've introduced Uber Balloon. I don't know how that works exactly. I guess you put in your location and all of a sudden psh, 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 a balloon comes out of nowhere. That's right. Can you imagine what a hot air balloon accident would look like? I mean, I guess they do happen. I mean, with two balloons, Well, you know these drones right at the airport. You get these drones slamming into planes. Can you imagine China? You know how many people are in China? A billion people. And Uber flying them around in a bunch of balloons. It's be like bumper cars. I tell you, they're going to get into trouble. They're going to need to call somebody. Yeah, that's right. If you get into a hot air balloon accident, you need to call my friend, Attorney James Bergener. We call him Sweet James. There's a reason. He's a good guy who will fight for you, fight for your rights, make sure you get a square deal. All right? And this is how this works. You know, you got an insurance company on the other side. And you know, they tell you, oh, we care. We got these hands. They love you. Oh, we love you. We love you. But you got to understand, they're every time they deny or delay a claim, every time they minimize a claim, that's money that they save for their shareholders. It's all about, it's okay. It's about profit. We celebrate that here on the program. But don't be a fool, okay? You've got to make sure that, don't even call them. Don't get into their little game. Call Sweet James, 1-800-881-2021. Let him fight for you and negotiate a fair deal. Visit sweetjames.com, get all the details, and just don't hesitate. You or a loved one, anything, any accident, injury, even if it's a hot air balloon accident, call him. Sweet James, 1-800-881-2021. All right. The Democrats are whining about the Benghazi report. Woo-hoo-hoo! One of the complaints, well, it was echoed by some Washington Post reporter, no doubt a Clinton campaign surrogate. Of course, he's an objective journalist. We all know that. Whining about the report, the committee costing $7 million. These rascally Republicans causing $7 million of government waste. Oh, this is great. For $7 million, what did the Benghazi committee achieve? Question mark. Oh, I don't know. Created a public record of all this absolute terrible stuff that we talked about last segment. Missed it? Get the podcast, samnation.com. So, what could they learn from the report that has so much value? Well, I don't know. Maybe you can't put a price tag on truth, but I'll tell you this. The State Department, yes, the State Department, the same place that Hillary Clinton occupied for a period of time. Yeah, well, so what did they spend money on? How about $5 million on glassware? Well, let me put this into perspective. So apparently, the State Department, yes, and this goes back, these purchase orders go back to Hillary Clinton's time. They spent $5 million, and it breaks down to about $400 a glass. Now, I just ordered some beautiful crystal from Europe. I was in the Czech Republic, and I picked up some Moser glassware. Crystal glassware. High-end stuff. I was doing the math because I read this article. I couldn't even believe it. I go, well, how much is... I got these glasses for $36 a glass. You're not telling me that somebody like the State Department that's buying glassware for its embassies... Have you heard of volume pricing? Have you heard of that? You know how when you buy 10 of something, you get a discount? You know, we know that, right? It's called Costco. I mean, for you really think that we like buying 10, 10 bags of oatmeal at a time? There's a reason we do it, right? And it's not to have 10 bags of Quaker Oats on hand at all given times. Because unless you have 12 kids, the only reason you're buying that much oatmeal is because you're getting a discount on it. So when you buy a bunch of glassware for every embassy around the world, you should be getting a discount. Well, Sam, maybe it wasn't your Czech stuff. It was something fancier. Well, it was U.S. Thank goodness they're at least giving us to a U.S. company. Of course, I'm guessing the stuff's made in China. But anyway, they found the vendor who sells this stuff and says, well, how much does this stuff really cost per glass? And he says, well, it's somewhere between $45 and $65 a glass. So my check pricing isn't that far off, is it? So pray tell me, what in the world is happening in our government spending $400 for something that costs $65? You know, at that rate, and I have to do the math, but it's less than a quarter. So that to me means, it's like a 4.3 we overpaid by, 3.8 million. Now, if you think 3.8 million is a lot of money, good, I do too. Mind numbing. Now, you know what else drove up the price on the Benghazi investigation? The fact that Hillary... I'm going to tell you, the fact that Hillary stonewalled this at every turn. Do you think I'm joking? You know Emailgate? You know what the State Department has said on Hillary Clinton's emails? Well, I don't know how CNN even reports this with a straight face. State Department lawyers argue in a filing made last Wednesday that gathering 450,000 pages of records, digital records, email records, would take them quite a bit of time. They can only process 500 pages a month. Meaning it would take approximately 16 and a half years to complete the review of just the Mills documents alone. and up to 33 years to review the finish of all the Sullivan documents. This is referring to the batches of documents that relate to Cheryl Mills, who was Hillary Clinton, one of Hillary Clinton's top aides, and then Sullivan, another one of her aides in the State Department. Oh, and another 25 years to review the Kennedy docs. So you know what that all adds up to? Well, if you're not a millennial, you can do math. 75 years. Are you kidding me? You know, I'm a lawyer. We do complex litigation. You know, you've seen it in movies. The other side brings a whole truck full of dots. Yo, here, you ask for all of our emails. Here, let me drop it off for you. Go find the smoking gun. Beep, beep, beep. Dump it. Okay? If a one law firm can process a bunch of documents, because you know what you do? Let me tell you, even if it's paper and it's typed, there's something called OCR. So you throw it into a copy machine, a scanner, and it goes brrrp, and out come digital PDFs that are searchable. So if you want a keyword, you can search it. And you know how long that search takes? 0.00 whatever seconds. So what do? You hire a monkey to sit there at the scanner going broop, 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 and there you go. But not when you're the State Department. So, well, no, but of course they could do it. Yes, of course. So my point is that this is stonewalling. This is just related to the emails. Does 75 years sound like it's significantly later than the election in November? Good. Yeah, it is. So what we have here, I mean, this is, and they say this with a straight face. And you know what? In this CNN report, I think this is the best part of the whole thing. They don't call BS on it at all. They just report it as a fact. They say, hey, you know, the State Department's saying it's going to take them 75 years to process these emails. And there's no opposing side view. There's no, I'm not saying I know it's not an opinion piece, but they don't quote somebody on the committee investigating it saying, that doesn't make any sense. Or saying anything like what I'm saying. It's not even there. These people. So if you missed yesterday's show and want to figure out what the whole Brexit thing was about, I'm to tell you, please get the podcast, because I took pretty much the whole hour to break down Brexit and what it means in Europe and all that. But we found this great art, and this is something that we didn't talk about yesterday. So I just want to talk to you about it briefly. A lot is being made of, you know, the Brits were really upset about that the European Union was telling them what kind of tea kettles they could and couldn't have. You guys remember this? The Brits love their tea. They love tea and crumpets. And suddenly the EU was saying, well, no, you can't have a kettle that has that much wattage. That's unsafe. You can't do that. You have to lower the wattage in your electric kettle. The Brits were really frustrated. So this reporter's doing a documentary on the sex trade. Some liberal guy is doing a documentary, and he's got a camera. He's got a digital camera, and it cuts off every 30 minutes of video. And he goes, why does it keep cutting off my video? And then he finds out the reason his camera's cutting out is because the European Union decided, some bureaucrat somewhere in Brussels, decided that in order for a digital camera to be called a digital camera, it can't record more than 30 minutes of video. So that's now Canon and everybody else is making a 29 minute, 59 second time limit on all videos. It's nuts. Can we just get the government out of our life? And yes, we can. Because tomorrow is the 4th of July and we're going to celebrate it. It's Independence Day. And I hope that when we're talking here, this time next year, we've taken our country back. Let's do that. SamNation.com. Find everything you need there. Have a great, happy, and safe 4th of July. God bless America. See you next week.